Can a competently composed work of fiction disrupt the culture of war? Does participation in the military inevitably lead to moral degradation? Why does the official story of 9/11 continue to dominate public discourse about the incident more than a decade after the story has been intelligently challenged? Is the 9/11 truth movement still relevant more than 15 years after those devastating attacks? On this week's edition of the Global Research News Hour, we feature two literary works countering mainstream narratives around warfare in the 21st century. We'll first hear from author Stan Goff about his first work of fiction, Smittengate. Later, we'll hear from author George Grundy about his book, Death of a Nation. On this week's program, two author interviews, Stan Goff's anti-war novel, George Grundy on 9/11 and the rise of fascism in America. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 27th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. North Korea finds itself in a win-win situation. If sanctions are eased and peace talks are managed in the right manner, then the process of socio-economic rebirth, which Kim Jong-un considers a priority, can begin. Should the rhetoric of war prevail in Washington, then Washington would find itself at odds with its main ally, Seoul. It is likely that China could even justifiably renounce its sanctions against the DPRK, blaming the U.S. for not making any progress in the face of extraordinary offers by Kim Jong-un to renounce his nuclear weapons. Washington would come across as the uncooperative party, and this would free the relevant parties, including allies, from taking the United States into consideration. That comes from the article, The Kim Moon DMZ Summit, Sophisticated North Korean Diplomacy Rewards Kim Jong-un, by Federico Pieraccini, posted April 27th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. On April 20th, North Korea made the dramatic announcement of several decisions that included suspending further nuclear and missile tests and that its nuclear test center would be discarded in order to ensure the transparency of the suspension of the nuclear test. A number of analysts, including a Washington Post column by Max Boot on Saturday, mistakenly dismissed the offer by claiming that the test site is probably unusable anyway. North Korea's Pungyi-ri nuclear test site, where North Korea has conducted six acknowledged underground detonations, is still, as far as we can tell, fully operational. Following Pyongyang's sixth nuclear test in September 2017, one area of the site, the North Portal, located at Mount Mantap, where the last five underground nuclear tests had been conducted, was apparently abandoned. However, significant new tunneling was noted at the West Portal, another area of the site, up through early March 2018. That comes from the article, DPRK's Closing the Pungyi-ri Nuclear Test Site, posted April 26th, originally appearing at 38 North. In the joint declaration, the two Koreas agreed to play their roles and take responsible actions for denuclearization of the peninsula and make every efforts to gain international support for it. Moon and Kim agreed to talk over peninsula issues and build trust through regular summits and hotline talks. Moon will also visit Pyongyang this autumn, they said. To relieve military tension and reduce the possibility of war, the South and the North decided to halt any hostile activities. From May 1st, they will stop propaganda broadcasting over the inter-Korean border and make the demilitarized zone a peace zone where there are no military weapons. That comes from the article, Koreas Agree to Call for Formal End to War This Year, by Kim Ron, posted April 27th, originally appearing at The Korea Times. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
John Wilson here. I'm speaking with an American anti-war activist and writer, Stan Goff. He had a long career in the U.S. Armed Forces from 1970 to 1996, and he has written numerous books about his experiences in the military and his opinions about many different aspects of war. His latest work, Smittengate, is actually a fictional story that delves into corruption, the sex trade within the military, and a specific character's family. Why did you decide to write this book?
I've been wanting to try fiction for a long time, but I'm kind of frightened of it. It's really intimidating because you have to think a lot harder than when you write nonfiction, and you have much, you feel like you have a much higher level of accountability. So I said I'd try it out, and then once I got it plotted out, I started sort of getting interested in my own characters and plugged away at it, you know, between doing other stuff, between writing a lot of nonfiction for the last, I don't know, 3 years or so. I don't know. I just wanted to. I wanted to have a story of some kind because one of my go-to theses in my nonfiction work is that human beings are story creatures. We really don't understand the concept until it's in the context of a story, so we can see how it fits into life. You know, the way that you live it. And that, you know, I just published in 2015 Borderline, which is like this incredibly lengthy tome on gender and militarism, but dealing with it sort of abstractly and through, you know, name dropping a lot of social critics and all that is one thing. It's another thing for to give examples of how that stuff actually plays out with people that you can identify with as just the same kind of, you know, screwed up people that you hang around with every day, you know.
Yeah, it's quite different than the kind of academic style or an abstract opinion, and it's really an interesting story. You have the main character Dale, and the kind of the stress he's dealing with, and not want to be a part of the the military, but kind of being thrown into one last position. So it's written very, like, there's a lot of detail, and obviously it seems like, you know, it could only be written by someone who had experiences like yourself. Can you go into how you use that in your writing this fictional story?
Well, I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write a story about, one that military people or ex-military people could identify with, because one of the things that annoys me as a former military, and I'm not valorizing that status in any way, I'm just saying one of the things that annoys me is to see how wrong a lot of writers get it when they write about the military. You know, they sort of rely on a lot of old, silly media-generated archetypes and whatnot. And then you have these sort of tropes that reoccur again and again, even the trope about the crazy veteran, though in this case, the fragmentation of his personality has to do with something else, you know, altogether. But, I'm losing the thread here, but I wanted people to have, who knew something about the military, not to be annoyed or disrupted in reading it by running into something that was obviously wrong. And the devil's always in the details and that stuff. And I actually had to, because I've been out for a long time, I had to go back and call on a couple of more recent veterans to ask them about, you know, things, changes in equipment, uniform, policy, regulations, yada, yada, yada. It's I've been out for 22 years now, so, you know, a lot has changed. But, yeah, I wanted, and I was also kind of trying to be a little sly. I wanted to write a book that looked like a war novel, that people who read war novels would pick up and then maybe dislocate them a little bit once they actually read the story.
Right. Yeah, it wouldn't be what they would expected, the pro war rah-rah kind of story that or kind of the special forces hero that you would probably normally see, I guess, like the Hollywood type of story, right?
Yeah. And now, I was never on a team like the team that's represented in there, but every one of those characters is similar in some way to people that I did know when I was in the military. And just for the record, there is nothing even remotely autobiographical about this. It's fiction, okay? But in terms of just the way the guys relate to each other on the teams and all that stuff, that's something I wanted to kind of capture, because it's kind of like a dysfunctional family, you know what I mean? It's not this strict unit that everybody, you know, salutes and shoots and follows orders like Robotrons and they're all Jason Bourne type characters.
Right.
They're not. Yeah. They're a bunch of, it's more of a frat boy atmosphere than an atmosphere of some highly disciplined, you know, highly organized outfit. It doesn't mean that they aren't trained in certain particular skills and can't do certain things, but a lot of people get this idea that these guys are like superhuman or someone. They're so brainwashed that they don't think and talk like the rest of us, and they really do. We do think and talk like everyone else. We listen to the same music. We're exposed to the same popular culture. You know what I mean? We have the same sense of humor and irony. So it's not like we're some other animal altogether. It's certainly not the idealized archetype where everybody's in it because, look, the guys that go into special operations in particular, patriotism might be a secondary motivation to them, but their main motivation is their violent thrill seekers. And their main motivation for that is to satisfy some conception of masculinity that they're trying to live into. And I say that from firsthand experience, but that was something that quest for masculinity was something that was universal in that world, in that little subset of the military.
And in the story, would you say that you have the element of there's the private contractor and sex trafficking going on that the group a lot of them participate in or kind of are interested in. So would you say that relates to the hyper masculinity of being able to just pay for sex from
Prostitution and the exploitation of prostituted women is something that exists on the periphery of every military activity and always has. In this case, we're talking about prostitution in a facility with underage girls that are being shifted around by military contractors. I actually sort of cribbed that from a lot of stuff that they caught people doing in Bosnia. Back when all that was going on, there were military contractors, and I forget which company. Now they've all changed their names, but, it was one of them. They start out like Blackwater, and then they call themselves the Institute for Peace or some shit. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
So, prostitution exists on the periphery of every military activity, and in places where people can get away with it, underage prostitution is quite popular. In fact, the most popular destination for, middle-class businessmen in the United States who are doing sex tourism is to go to places like Thailand where they can go have sex with 12-year-old girls and stuff, and then come back and, they're just respectable, dads again when they get back. And that's a man thing. Not a military thing, but when you get in the military, you've got all the man things concentrated, especially in special operations where these units are exclusively or almost exclusively male. All the same problems only amplified because men around other men feed off that stuff. They pump each other up. They get into a kind of an escalation dynamic of who can be most probative of one's own masculinity. And you've seen that. You've seen that with mm-hmm. the guys.
The main character you have, Dale, he's one who takes exception to that, and I guess, you know, you set that up with his family life and how close he is with his daughter. Do you think, you know, that would play a big role, you know, just him, maybe he wasn't like that before he had a family, or would you say it's just certain people, you know, don't...
I don't want to be too much of a spoiler for the next one, because I'm going to sort of dive into a little bit more of his... of his background, but Dale was someone who was never should have gone into the military, and it was almost inevitable that he would. And like I say, I don't want to spoil the sequel.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are guys that go in and think they can still maintain their integrity, and that integrity somehow corresponds to. A duty ethic, you know what I mean, and that itself that in turn corresponds to a higher good, you know, that's carried out by the state. No, you know, it's just standard modern episteme. And there's guys that go in thinking they can live into that stuff, and there's guys that go in thinking they can live into that stuff when they get in these cagey units. But when you get in there, that's not the foundation of the culture. It's a culture of ruthlessness, and ruthlessness never corresponds to moral improvement. It always corresponds to moral degradation. Now, when Dale discovers the level of degradation he's fallen to, that's when his personality begins to fragment, and he begins to have some dissociative episodes and whatnot start coming out at inconvenient times, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
The name of the book is Smitten Gate. Is there a specific meaning to that, to the title?
Yeah, it's sort of a midrash on the Isaiah quote in the epigraph. It's the Smitten Gate refers to the gate at the entry gate to the city of chaos, which is a prediction of a fallen Jerusalem, and one where people have pulled back inside their houses to hide. You know, so it's in fact the original title of the book before I changed it was going to be City of Chaos. That's directly from the quote, but I wanted to be just a wee bit more subtle than that.
Speaking of chaos, there is a...
But it's also, you know, and the idea of a broken door or a broken portal sort of says something about what's going on with Dale. But what's also going on with the beginning of the loss of innocence on the part of D'Angelo, too. His daughter.
Right,
D'Angelo Dale is his daughter. And he has a very loving relationship with her, but one that is conflicted by the fact that he refuses to live with his wife, which is sort of explained in the book. The overview is that Dale is this guy who... when he's a young fella, he's out tramping around Latin America, meet somebody in Belize, fall in love, come back, and they have a child. Their child turns out to be a prodigy. And they really, 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 really want to sort of maximize her potential. And so... they need, for a young guy that has nothing but an English degree and can't get a job, he finds out he can go in the Army and his wife is a nurse, and they can make enough money to pay for this child's education. But the place he has to go to pay for that education is the military. Then when he gets in there, it turns out that he's actually quite good at everything because he enjoys the challenge. He's very physical. And he sort of moves up He just moves up because he's constantly seeking these new challenges, which is part of his character, which should be good, but it takes him to a very dark place. And then one of the turning points is in Somalia, where he is a participant in the Task Force Rangers debacle there. And then the real turning point comes when he's sent to perform an assassination in Honduras in support of the 2009 coup, and it turns out to be a former colleague of his. And then things start to go to pieces. Well, long story short, he gets sent away to sort of cool his heels at language school out in California. And then after a year, when he's learned Farsi, he goes back and he's assigned to this team in Afghanistan. And as soon as he hits the ground, he's already losing his mind. And he's assigned to this team and assigned to this sort of high priority mission at the same time that his team is involved in committing a crime. And I won't say any more than that because it'll sort of throw it. But, you know, at this point, it's like, what could go wrong?
Yeah. The story does have a lot of, I guess there's a lot of graphic elements in the writing. Is there a reason you decided to include things like that, kind of like the violence and sex and things like that?
Yeah, because people, it's irresponsible, in my opinion, to treat sex like it exists apart from power. It's irresponsible, in my opinion, to sanitize war. And those are two of the themes that sort of thread in and out of one another. Sex is always implicated with power, and war is always an obscenity. But what do I mean when I say that, and how do those two things relate to one another? And you kind of begin to see it. Again, it all goes back to these phenomena sort of orbit around this notion, this notion of escalating masculinity. But yeah, it's graphic because I don't want to sanitize military life. You can turn on the television and see people sanitize military life, you know, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You can find plenty of people who want to write about sex like it's, oh, just the greatest thing in the world, and oh, no problem, and sex is, sex is fun and yada, yada, yada. But the fact is, real sex for most people in real life is implicated with power, and that power is patriarchal. And I think it's irresponsible to write about sex that way, especially about, and it's kind of interesting that the book came out in the same year that the whole Me Too thing took off, because it's all of a sudden women are beginning to reassert that and say, you know, you guys want to talk about sex? Well, let's talk about how you employ your power as males in the realm of sex. And all of a sudden, sex doesn't become so innocent anymore. And by writing graphically about it, I'm trying to tell the truth.
Now you're already working on a sequel. To the.
It's going to take a lot longer because.
Were you kind of on that track before you finished this book, or did you decide, because it's your first big kind of fiction, published. So now you're on board with doing that?
Yeah. When I started plotting out the first one, I couldn't satisfy myself to finish it, without, looking at where it was going to lead. And in a way, I always kind of had my mind on the sequel when I was writing the first one. Again, maybe I'm just being, too clever by half, but I want the first book to pique somebody's curiosity if they're about to read that kind of thing. But the real story is in the sequel. The big story is in the sequel. And by the time the sequel comes out, then really the first book is just an appendage to it. It's something someone might read after they read New Moons. It's called New Moons and Sabbaths. an Isaiah reference again. I want to stay consistent. Mm-hmm. But, the person that I really want to put out there as a character that might reoccur in later novels is D'Angelo Dale. But I can't write the book about D'Angelo Dale without writing the book about Abner Dale, her father.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens in the book, I don't want to give anything away, is so pivotal for the rest of her life.
So you're very busy in getting this next one. Yeah.
There's other people from the book that are going to come back. There's other characters. Farah, her mother's going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
A couple members of Dale's old team will show up again in there. And even one of the journalists will show up in there again. So we're going to bring them back. But then we're going to relocate them in a fictional town called Washington, New York, somewhere within 45 minutes of Syracuse.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the... a lot of the themes of the story, but is there any kind of other themes that you really want to kind of get across or points that you want to get across besides telling the story, like having the interesting characters and developing and showing this perspective inside the military?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I wanted to do was, like I say, the character development for Dale. I'm going to do more character development on Dale in the second book, maybe, than I did in the first book. And I did a lot of character development on D'Angelo in the first book, but that's going to go much further in the second book. And D'Angelo, his daughter, becomes the main character. But one of the things about D'Angelo's character, and this is something that a lot of people don't realize about military cultures, and particularly in the Army, is probably the most racially integrated culture in the United States. I'm talking about people where people live cheek by jowl with one another, don't just share consumer spaces. I mean, live with one another, watch one another's back, work with each other every day, learn the same language, wear the same clothes, and marry one another across those boundaries that are firmer outside the military. So in a sense, the military, for all its negatives, also has a sort of interesting creolism about it. And so that's kind of what led me to pick Farah as his love interest in the first one, because she's Garifuna from Belize. She's coming from a very Creole culture, going to another Creole culture. And one of the things that I kind of see going on that's not talked about very much in the United States, but particularly with millennials and younger people, is even at this point where race has become this huge visible issue again with the polarization of American politics around this, you know, sort of chronic insecurity, at the same time, our culture is now, especially with younger people, is more creolized, and I think that's a good thing. There are a lot of different kinds of what you call cultural fusion, I guess, going on, and I think it's going to redefine us demographically in 20 or 30 years. I just wanted to come up with a character that sort of represented something about that. Someone that doesn't exactly fit in any of the cliques that are out there now, but that also is a very integral, self-confident character. And that's one thing D'Angelo is someone who is simultaneously doesn't belong but still retains her self-confidence, and I think it makes an interesting character. Especially as she gets older and suffers more of the slings and arrows of fortune, because the sequel is going to be 8 years after the first book.
So thanks so much for doing this interview.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Jonathan Wilson here, and I'm speaking with a very special guest we have. He's an English-Australian author, media professional, blogger, and a businessman, and he's also the subject of today's interview. We're going to talk about his most recent book. It's titled Death of a Nation, 9/11 and the Rise of Fascism in America. It's George W. Grundy. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Pleasure.
Now, I guess first, this book, based on the title, you could almost imagine it being about a bunch of different things. Which it is, but it does have one main focus. Could you kind of get into the focus of your book and kind of the timeline it covers?
Well, look, your question is correct in that the book is about a couple of different topics. It starts, the first half of the book is about the events of September the 11th, 2001, arguing that that particular event was falsely portrayed to us, and in fact, was carried out by the United States government and military, an attack on their own country in order to carry out a series of geopolitical maneuvers, which they did. But the second half of the book focuses on the effect of September the 11th, the effect of that devastating event on American political society, which I would argue has pushed America's center of politics so far to the right now that the word fascism isn't necessarily an overstatement anymore.
And so how did you, I guess, undertake this giant, compilation of information? Like the book is, just over 500 pages, and especially getting into all these details of the 9/11 attacks. Now, I'm someone who... spent a lot of time reading about all this kind of information, and I feel like you didn't miss much, that you could include, right? There's so much there. So how did you undertake this?
Look, you're right. It was a pretty big undertaking. The book itself took me just over 3 years to write, and there's an enormous amount of information in there. So yeah, it's a very, very long book, filled with a large amount of information. But perhaps I should explain how the process of questioning that event came about, because I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not necessarily one of those people who believes that the lizard people run the world and Diana was killed by the British government. Now, there's lots and lots of conspiracy theories out there. I'm not necessarily a conspiracy theorist at all. My curiosity in this event came about several years after 9/11, when I saw some footage of the seventh tower of the World Trade Center collapsing, and that seemed to me a peculiar event. Most people are actually unaware that the third tower collapsed full in New York on 9/11, even to this day. And I just looked into that very casually and curiously, just to see if I could find an explanation as to why a 50-story building would have fallen down 7 hours after the attacks, and I couldn't find one. And the more I looked into that particular aspect of the story, the more I just found it concerning. The more I found that I couldn't resolve these things in my mind. So over a period of years, I started to put together information on that event, on that particular aspect of the event, but also all the other things that happened on 9/11. And what I found was, from my perspective, that not only was the Tower 7 collapse inexplicable, but there were lots and lots and lots of other things that happened on September the 11th that defy logic, that defy explanation, that defy the laws of physics. In the end, the other thing that I found amazing about it, and it's all surprisingly obvious, it's all been a lot of the information that I found and collated came from very reputable sources. I was published in the New York Times. And I find that pretty interesting in itself, that there is so much information that contradicts the official story. And yet the official story has held up remarkably well in terms of public belief over the last 17 years.
That's true. It's 2018 now, and most people kind of scoff at a lot of the questions people still have about the events on September 11th, 2001.
And another thing, your book, you really delve into the connections of those in power at the time with those who are blamed for the attacks. So you have the Osama bin Laden family and the Bush family, you know, in businesses together, having this history. And these are all things that, you know, those are interesting facts that have come out that people are go, wow, that's a weird coincidence. Or, oh, that's interesting. But in your book, when you just see it kind of, you know, chapter after chapter, and you're like, not only the events of that day, but then the background, and then the people who are supposedly behind it, and then you have the connections with the Saudi Arabian government and how close they are. It's it matches the tone of your book, which I found your tone is like you're talking about how absurd this is.
Well, at the very least, I mean, no matter what you believe, you have to admit it's an absolutely unbelievable coincidence that the connections between the Bush family and the bin Laden family are so extensive that the two protagonists, the two main protagonists in this story, happen to be connected so extensively. I mean, it's mind-boggling, whether you're a believer in the official story or otherwise, that as the attacks commence, the president's father is having breakfast with Osama bin Laden's brother. I mean, that's at the very least a mind-boggling aspect of the story. But there's so much more across the various protagonists, particularly the Bush family and their connections with the Saudis, that makes it begins to strain credulity when you look at how they treated the Saudis that were all trapped in the United States after the attacks, and the way that they managed to basically shepherd bin Laden family figures out of the country in a period when no commercial flights were allowed to take to the air. That seems strange. What I found was overall that you can put together a series of arguments about the events on the day, but surrounding that, there are so many other questionable events, happening things that put them together and you think to yourself, well, that seems strange. And then you come across another one and you go, well, that's amazing. But then you put 200 of them in a row and you go, well, I can't support the weight of this bizarre coincidence here, there, and everywhere, and still hold faith in the official story.
And I agree, you know, at this time it's so late to kind of have, you know, hope that this event is going to be exposed or fully drawn out, or the people involved would be prosecuted at this point. What are you kind of, you know, this book kind of paints a dark picture where this is just on the road towards a more dark future for the United States, especially with Trump in power. Is that a fair assessment of what you're thinking this is leading to?
I guess so. I mean, look, many of the main protagonists from the United States these days are now very, very old men. I point the finger at people like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. I'm not in favor of exonerating old people just because they're old, but 17 years has passed. And the story remains sacrosanct. And I think, to me, at this stage, I feel very comfortable in my assertion that 9/11 was overall a falsely characterized event. So I think what's interesting these days, I find it continually fascinating, is how to voice this opinion remains completely beyond the pale. And although the numbers that they, when they occasionally do surveys of Americans and other nations, asking them about their belief in how the events of September the 11th worked, they often find that a surprisingly large number of people are able to countenance the notion that on one level or another, the Bush administration either participated in or was aware of the attacks coming prior to their arrival. Those numbers are pretty solid even now, but in the mainstream media, to voice this sort of opinion is to just to put your head on a chopping block, to assume that you're going to get shouted down as a lunatic, as someone who's completely out of their mind, beyond the pale. But on a broader scale, the thing that I find interesting is that without an exposure, without this event being re-examined, it invites a future one. It seems to me that it was broadly successful from the protagonist's point of view. They managed to carry out an attack, get away with it, not have that fairly obvious lie exposed, continue to hold political power, in fact have more political power, which they exploited because of the devastation of 9/11, and then carry out most of the things that they said they wanted to carry out in pre-published documents, which came out a year before 9/11. It seems like a successful venture, if you ask me.
Right, and you're talking about specifically the Project for a New American Century document, talking about the ongoing wars that were going on now, the hope for that and the need for an event to trigger the public acceptance of that, which happened, and those people were in power at the time. What would you say, you mentioned before your point about mainstream acceptance is kind of out of the question at this point. It seemed like there was a time maybe 10 years ago where the questions were being brought forward. But now, for instance, I'll notice anyone, even in Canada, say someone running for politics, if there's something on their Twitter account that they question something about 9/11, that would be them being kicked out of the party immediately. Is it that way in Australia?
Oh, look, down here in Australia, we're more focused on Australian things most of the time. But yeah, look, certainly there's nothing in the mainstream media that ever makes it there, mm-hmm. which has a sensible person questioning that event in a sensible, methodical way, where they aren't just dismissed as a lunatic, as a the conspiracy theorist is a tag which people put on people who voice these sort of things, and it's sort of code for a crazed lunatic, and it's a really good way of putting people down. So no, I don't. I think there is no way at the moment of voicing concerns like this within a mainstream media platform without just being subject to vilification and being characterized as a deranged idiot.
Mm-hmm. So have you kind of felt any of that kind of treatment after publishing this book? I mean, I guess you've been writing about this for a while, obviously doing all this research. So, are people, maybe people you know, in just general relationships, not work relationships, do they tread lightly around these subjects around you?
No, absolutely not. And that's the interesting thing, is that I've obviously sold some copies of the book around the world, and I've received emails and reviews from people all over the place, mostly supportive. The reviews I get tend to get 5 stars or 1 star,
right?
Which is fine with me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, personally, across the board, I'm a pretty regular kind of guy. I'm not living a vastly alternative lifestyle, so I meet a lot of people who are white-collar businessmen, normal, mainstream, center-ish people, and I've told them that I've written this book, given them copies. Lots of my friends and associates, and people I work with, have read the book, read the contents, and it's amazing how very few of them have come back and said, "No, I think this is complete rubbish." And I don't think they're just being nice to me. I think it's amazing how across the board, and not just in my social circle, but across the board, people are very open to the idea. People are very open to the concept of examining the idea that potentially there is something more to this story than we were told. And potentially even the easiest way in is to discuss the idea that potentially the Bush administration was so negligent in the months and year coming up to that event, that it almost amounts to complicity. And then from there, people can get themselves across the board to the point where they think to themselves, well, look, I'm willing to accept the notion that the Bush administration purposely ignored warnings in order to allow this thing to happen. But it is a leap of faith, and I think that's one of the reasons why, in some ways, the story was so successfully held up, is to reach the point where I have, for example, really makes you re-examine virtually everything you assume about society, because it's such a big event. I mean, obviously, it's the largest event in most of our lives, the largest current affairs event. And in order to re-examine it completely and come to the conclusion that I have, which I still find disturbing, really forces you to re-examine virtually everything you assume about society. And that's, I think, one of the barriers to entry, if you will, to people coming to the conclusions that I have, because you have to just change everything you think.
I also want to ask you about, I guess, the difference between getting this information out to people now, like 2018, whereas maybe when the ability to get this kind of information in 2005 or 6. So now with so much social media and kind of the explosion of all these different facets of the internet, it might seem like it's easier, but I almost feel like there's too much and too many people who can post their own YouTube videos of edits of questioning things, where how does someone start somewhere, you know, if they're questioning 9/11?
Like I said before, I mean, I found that the information on the event of 9/11 was surprisingly mainstream, surprisingly obvious, and surprisingly easy to get. I agree that we live in a world that's so stratified these days that it's a slightly different paradigm to the one we had back in 2018. But I still think that the information is there. It's fairly easy to understand. But on a broader scale, the problem I think we face as a society these days is that people live in little silos of information. People get their information via things like Facebook. That means that you generally find that a lot of people get their information from people who already agree with them, people who are already feeding them that which they already know, that don't feed them challenging notions. And that is a concern, I think, not just for American society, but for all society, because eventually what it leads to is people being misinformed. And that was, I think, fairly spectacularly shown during the 2016 American election.
Yeah, it's definitely threw a lot of people for a loop. But I guess, you know, when people live in their own world, they're not exposed to the other extreme views out there, right? Is that fair to say that that I guess people need to broaden their horizons and the way our information society is constructed, it's kind of against that because it wants us to click on the things we like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, what would you say your thoughts are on, because this event, you know, the 9/11, attacks and people questioning it kind of spurred a movement to activism, people trying to get information out, especially, you know, difficult thing to do early on. And now there's a lot of ways to get information out, but, what are your thoughts on kind of what the 9/11 truth movement has accomplished or failed to accomplish in kind of exposing this?
That's a good question. I'm not really a part of the 9/11 truth movement in that I'm not a member of any particular group. I think that over the years, the 9/11 truth movement has, for the most part, been pretty helpful. It is, it's been filled with a lot of people who are reputable and intelligent and have asked legitimate questions. And just like in most other groups, there are some kooks. There are some people out there who claim that there were no planes that hit the buildings or that there were holograms or things like that.
Right.
And that's for people trying to seek, inverted commas, the truth, that can be unhelpful. Because you know, there are some lunatics out there who are, you know, going on about lizards and no planes and that sort of thing, and that's just But overall, look, over the years, the 9/11 truth movement has brought out some very, very smart people who've put together some very, very smart and intelligent papers and books, which have been reasonably widely disseminated. And I think overall, there is a broad consciousness, certainly in the American public. We see this from anecdotal and survey evidence that there are some significant questions about 9/11. And even if you're not willing to cross that particular Rubicon and become someone who holds an entire question mark over the event, I think there is a broad consciousness that there are some aspects to that day's events which are extremely questionable.
Mm-hmm. And there's still, it's not like information won't still come out. And specifically, you know, recently there was the declassified paper talking about the connections to Saudi Arabia and funding some of those the suspected of carrying out the attack and things like that. The mainstream it seemed to kind of cover it, but you know, gloss over it like this case is still closed. But yet, like you say, the information's readily available to those who want it. Do you expect any other kind of maybe not bombshells, but more kind of important information to still come out?
That's a good question. It's I think there is somewhere in this world some bombshell evidence. I think, for example, to take one example, the Pentagon building, which was covered in CCTV cameras, none of that footage has ever been released except for five frames, which didn't show a plane. And there was various other Sheraton Hotel and various other businesses nearby who had CCTV cameras that would have captured that the last moments of the alleged flight. I think that footage may be somewhere sitting in a drawer, and if that came out, that could provide bombshell evidence. Whether it will, I doubt. But over time, these things, you know, unfortunately, we the public are deemed privy to these things in a very slow, deliberative process. I mean, my understanding is that there's a series more of the JFK papers that are due to come out, I think, next month.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, 55 years after the event. So, you know, that these things may dribble out in the end, but by then it will be too late. And that's what concerns me, is that anyone questioning whether this is something we should focus on, given it was nearly 17 years ago, just turn on the radio, just turn on the TV, watch for an hour, watch Fox for an hour. See how long you wait before you hear the term 9/11, because the power of the event is still very much there in the public consciousness. It's used all the time. Whenever there's any reference to America's national security, to terrorism, to the need for the wars, for the need for the military budget, count the seconds until you hear someone just say 9/11. Because of 9/11, we need to do this. Because of 9/11, this justifies some other thing. And that to me is the key aspect of the story today, because it's a story that happened 17 years ago. You could easily say it was a terrible day. There were some terrible people. Even if they did it, well, look, they're old men now. It's gone, but it isn't gone. If you turn on the media, it's there all the time. It justifies everything that goes on in America and all their spending. And behind it is the threat of another attack. Behind it is the fear, and I think it should be most people's greatest fear, is what happens in the United States if there is another major terrorist attack under a man like Donald Trump. Because I don't think you need to be a conspiracy theorist or even, you know, a liberal to be concerned that a man with authoritarian tendencies like Trump and the power of the state now behind him in many ways exaggerated and concentrated because of 9/11. In the event of an attack, Trump will ruthlessly exploit that for his own political gain. I think it would be something that he would view as, I was almost going to say, desirable. And that's to me, the crux of the story today is that power of that event 17 years ago is still very much there.
All right, that's great. So, thank you so much for doing this interview, George W. Grundy. The book is Death of a Nation, 9/11 and the Rise of Fascism in America. Thanks so much for doing this interview.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Jonathan.
This is Michael Welch, the Global Research News Hour. Thanks for those interviews, John.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
First of all, with Stan Goff's Smittengate, I was wondering what your reaction was to the way this, as a work of fiction, might help to undermine these the narratives around war.
It definitely gives a different perspective. You have a bunch of kind of frat boys thrown together in this foreign land, and it's just kind of. The characters you see how being put in this kind of moral ambiguity, they often kind of will go for the lowest common denominator, whereas there's the sex trafficking involved in the book and how prevalent that is and commonplace, kind of accepted among people involved in war-torn areas who are kind of, you know, in a all-male environment. So it kind of touched on a lot of those aspects that you don't ever really see much of in kind of war military-based fiction.
George Grundy's book, as relevant as it might be to question the official story of 9/11, it doesn't seem to be as necessary as debunking a lot of the narratives around Russiagate and Russian interference with the elections. I just wanted to know if you have any thoughts about, if you are in full agreement with Mr. Grundy about that relevance, or maybe there's a caveat there.
I would say, you know, they're related in some ways, but, you know, they're completely different. You know, election fraud and kind of the idea of democracy is completely, you know, it seems like a frail thing at this point. We're like, oh, everyone voted for this guy. But then you also look back and you're like, well, does it even matter if everyone, you know, the people you vote in are involved in this kind of terrorism, you know, false flag terrorism or these kind of,
yeah,
these kind of deceptions. The possibility of behind the scenes can make things really confusing. But at the same time, you go back to 9/11, you're like, well, we've never recovered from that.
Hmm. You pointed out social media, and yet we've got what we call fake news, which includes a lot of mainstream media stuff. And that might be I think you suggested in the interview, a critical distinction from that, just the early years around 9/11.
Yeah. And the independent media, you could kind of, it was easier to critically analyze and be like, oh, okay, these people are legit independent media or, you know, but who knows, you know, who's funding what independent, in quotations, media these days. And there's so much of it. So everyone can be kind of living in whatever reality they choose. But it's great that these books like Grundy's book, when you put things in a book and get it published, it allows you to kind of critically look things over, you know, all in one place and kind of make decisions based on that.
Okay. Well, John Wilson, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's guest interviewer, Jonathan Wilson. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.